Ayı Kafe'ye hoş geldiniz. Bugün sevgili doktor arkadaşım Susan Blank'le yaptık bölümü. Konumuz A4M'in konferansıydı ve de fonksiyonel tıbbın değer önerileri hakkında konuştuk. Yayın İngilizce olacak. Arzu edenler YouTube'un çeviri altyazısını kullanarak takip edebilirler. Susan'la ilgili daha detaylı bilgi almak istiyorsanız longevilab.com'u ziyaret edebilirsiniz. Ben Esra Çavuşoğlu. 18 yıldır ayık bir hayat yaşıyorum. Bağımlılık hastalığıyla mücadelem, beni beden ve zihin performansımı iyileştirmek, hayat kalitemi arttırmak, daha sağlıklı ve uzun yaşamak için yeni yöntemler, cihazlar ve takviye ürünler araştırmaya yönlendirdi. Bağımlılık hastalığı, biohacking ve longevity alanlarındaki kendi deneyimlerimden, dünyadaki son gelişmelere, çığır açan girişimcilerden uzman akademisyenlere, yıllardır yaptığım sohbetler artık her hafta Ayık Kafa Podcast'te. Finally, my dear friend, mentor, the person that I look up to, my doctor, and also someone that anytime I have a problem, I pick up the phone or go next to her. Finally, Dr. Susan Blank is with us. Hi, Dr. Blank.
Hello, it's such a pleasure to be with you, and it's very nice to see you.
This podcast is not going to be about addiction, which is your specialty. You're an addiction psychiatrist. Also, you're a forensic psychiatrist, as well as board-certified functional medicine doctor. I want to speak more about functional medicine because, as you know, I just came back from A4M conference in Las Vegas. I already did an episode of Ayık Kafa about the conference, things that I saw. And now I want to discuss with you things that made me think whether I should take it seriously or I should have a bit of a question mark. But I want to start with, what made you attracted to functional medicine?
That's a very good question. Years ago, when I was working and studying pain management, I was involved in an interventional pain practice where I learned how to put in spinal cord stimulators and indwelling pain pumps to treat really intractable chronic pain. And while I was doing that work and studying for boards in that particular specialty, I began to read some literature about the neuroendocrine effects of people who used opioids, which are pain medications that are used much more commonly in the United States than around the world, unfortunately. But that's another story for another day. But as I was reading this literature, they were saying that even people taking normal doses of these opioid painkillers that were pharmaceutical grade, that were prescriptions written by their doctor, and the patient was filling at their pharmacy, that it was having an impact on the pituitary gland. And the pituitary gland, if you don't know, is straight back behind your nose between your eyes. It's a tiny little gland about the size of the tip of my little finger. And its job is to measure all the hormones that are circulating in our system, whether they're coming from the thyroid, whether they're coming from the ovaries or the testes, whether they're coming from the adrenal glands, the pancreas. All of these different hormones are measured and regulated by the pituitary gland. So if there's too much, then it says back down the production. If there's not enough, it says increase the production. But what happens when you're taking certain medications and the drugs and substances that we know as being addictive, when you're taking these particular substances, even if you don't have the disease of addiction, and even if you're taking them by doctor prescription, one of the things that happens is the pituitary gland stops doing its job. It just goes on vacation. And so what this particular article that I first read was about was testosterone levels in men. And what it said was these patients taking opioids for chronic pain, and again, they weren't abusing them. They weren't taking too much. They weren't taking street drugs. They were taking pharmaceuticals that they picked up from their local pharmacy. The suppression, as we call it, or the dampening of the pituitary's work was a great cause of concern because the pituitary stopped measuring these men's testosterone. It stopped sending out the message, make more testosterone, and it stopped sending out the message to make more sperm. So these men were now not only suffering from the symptoms of low testosterone, but they were becoming infertile. They weren't able to have children. And I'm thinking, okay, my patients who have the disease of addiction and chronic pain, they are often taking way higher doses than a doctor would recommend. They're sometimes taking street drugs. They're using heroin. What must this be doing to their endocrine function? So I started to investigate this. And we did a pilot study with the University of Georgia looking at the first 50 men that came into my clinic for treatment of addiction, of any kind of addiction. And what we saw was out of these 50 men, only one man had a normal testosterone for his age. And everybody else, even 18, 19, 20-year-old men had testosterone, in some cases, less than a female. And this began my quest to go, okay, what's going on? Maybe a lot of the symptoms that we see of related to their disease of addiction could actually be traced back to not having enough testosterone. So in my quest to get someone to help me regulate and figure out how to treat these men, at the time it was just men that I had information about, I couldn't find an endocrinologist who was interested. They just said, well, we don't deal with testosterone, go see a urologist. The urologist going, we don't treat testosterone deficiency in a 20-year-old. So long story, I decided at that point, I can't get anyone to help me with my patients and they need help. So I'm going to have to go and figure out how to do this myself. And that's when I enrolled, with your help, Ezra, for which I'm very grateful. I enrolled in the fellowship with A4M to get certified in functional medicine and advanced functional medicine. This was a big change in how I saw the disease of addiction, how I treated patients, and how I began to understand the impact of even regular normal use of things like alcohol or marijuana could be significantly impacting someone's endocrine function, meaning their hormone levels.
Can you explain what is this certification? Because in Turkish, when we translate, people may not understand the importance to be a board-certified functional medicine doctor, and they may be confusing with just having a certification. Because many times we spoke, I asked you, and you clearly said, yeah, I can totally drop psychiatry, and I can become just a functional medicine doctor, correct?
Correct. Around the world, not just in the United States, but in order to receive this additional board certification in functional medicine, you have to do your undergraduate work. Then you have to do the 4 years of medical school. Then you have to do specialty training. You can't just go from being an MD and graduating medical school. They want you to have also done a residency training. So in my case, I did an extra 5.5 years in training in psychiatry and head trauma. After that, then I signed up to start taking these courses. And I took 12 of these modules that take about 3.5 days each. And these are long days, starting at 8 a.m. and going to 8 p.m., studying different aspects of treating people from a more wellness point of view. After you complete all of those courses, and because I was working full time and had my active practice, it took me 2.5 years to complete that coursework. After I completed the coursework and they said, you are now eligible to sit for the board certification, I had to go, and I think I went to Las Vegas actually, to take my written exam. And then after I passed the written exam, you have to pass that, which takes 3 or 4 hours. Then you have to sit for an oral exam. And there are 2 or 3 physicians who are evaluating you. They present you with a patient. You hear about the patient. You have to evaluate, talk about what's your differential diagnosis? What do you think this patient might have? How would you go about investigating? What lab work would you do? What physical exam? What would you be looking for? And then what's your treatment plan? And you go through this grilling by these doctors, and they're very good. And honestly, it's very nerve-wracking because you don't want to miss anything. But anyway, once you finish that, if they say you've passed, then you are awarded a board certification. So it's not just a simple process. It can take years, and it's not guaranteed that you're going to be given the board certification just because you took the training and just because you sat for the exam. You have to pass those things, and you have to maintain afterwards continued education every year to maintain your board certification.
All right. That was very clear. In a bit, I'm going to also ask you the difference between A4M and IFM, but I've been in your practice many times. As I said, you explained actually very well. I wanted to start like that because not only if people are addicted to something that they would destroy their system, their brain, their cellular system, their levels of supplements or minerals, also if people are having not a really healthy life, let's say, even a healthy life, but under not healthy conditions, they may need to be approached by functional medicine approach, I would see.
One of the problems with modern medicine is that each specialty has become so narrowly focused that this doctor only treats shoulder pain. This doctor only works on your eyes. This doctor only works on your heart, but only in the blood vessels of your heart. So there's no one generally looking at the whole person and trying to figure out not just what I see as someone who has the disease of addiction, but how has this impacted their overall physical, emotional, social health? How are all of these parts of them been affected by this disease? And that's what functional medicine is about, looking at not just what is the problem in front of you, but all the factors that might be contributing to why you're having trouble. And sometimes that's not really clear. And as a psychiatrist, I find this all the time. People come in, they're depressed, their primary care doctor or their OBGYN has started them on an antidepressant, and it's still not helping. And this is the other part of my quest in studying functional medicine, is to find out, this is a good medicine, this patient's a good candidate, why is it not helping? And very often when I do my studies, I find out, oh, it's not a problem with the neurotransmitter serotonin, our mood regulator. They actually have a thyroid problem, or they actually don't have enough vitamin B12, folate, or vitamin D. There are lots of things. And if we treat those things and improve that part of their well-being, their depression is often lifted, their medications work better, or we can even take them off the medication because that's not the real problem. So it's this digging deeper and going outside the common cause solution that is so prevalent now in modern medicine.
Let's get now a little deeper into the conference, because I wish you would be able to understand me, but you can watch it with the English subtitle, my podcast that was aired just today. So I discussed a couple of issues, the funny things, such as there's not healthy food around. I was locked into a Las Vegas hotel, but these are not the things that I want to discuss with you about. In between the lectures and the exhibition hall, I started seeing some I don't want to say unethical because it's not up to me, but you know, the person who's giving the education suddenly is presenting a supplement. And you know, firms over there giving too many promises without being able to prove them, in my opinion. And also these crossfire in between supplement companies or testing companies, even in between speakers almost, like one says, use this hormone. The other says, what's the credential of that person? Why would you listen to? So there's like, for someone like me, who is an end user and very curious about these things start making me think. So what's your take about that?
Fortunately, you have a curious mind. And fortunately, you don't accept things just because somebody endorsed them. So you have a curiosity, frankly, most people don't, which creates these kinds of situations where people can be swayed. People can be enticed to purchase something or try this new therapy because they don't know how to have that scientific investigative mind to dive deeper. And this is one of the complaints that I have about A4M, is that many of the conferences, let me just clarify for a second here, the lectures and the certification training, when you go to those lectures, the person delivering the lecture is giving you the references. Where in the scientific literature does this have its background? And you have this whole list of articles and textbooks and scientific medical literature that backs up what they're telling you. That is not the case with the conference. Conference is very much driven by the industry, which is good because it allows you on the one hand to see all the new innovative thinking, all the new people, all the new ideas that people are having. But it's confusing because these ideas are presented as though these are firm facts, and sometimes they are, versus this is a great idea that we came up with, and here's a way that we can sell supplements, instruments, or home training kinds of equipment. So the way that the conferences run, and this is true with many conferences, whether it's in the tech industry, whether it's in the food processing industry, very often, and you have to be careful about conferences because you need to understand that some of the conferences are based on, I have a product, I'm going to give you, the conference developers, this much money, you're going to let me have a booth, you're going to let me have my name on the bag that all the participants get, and you're going to give me 2 lecture spots for however much that money might cost. And so their people that they pick are going to stand up and give lectures to the whole conference about their product or their research. And then you can walk outside just as you did, go to the exhibition hall, and there is that same person who just gave a lecture now selling the product. It may be very good. It may be as testified to by this lecturer, but it may not be. And it may not be completely ready for prime time. And it may not have the rigorous scientific background studies that we would hope. And so this creates this situation where the conference is supported and paid for by the industry, as opposed to like other conferences, for example, the American Society of Addiction Medicine. That is a very rigorous conference. The speakers are not paid. They have to go through rigorous oversight and evaluation of their topic, their research. You can't buy a spot to speak at this conference, for example. It is not industry supported, although they do have a conference hall and they do have, you know, various and sundry addiction treatment providers exhibiting. The information given in the conference is scientifically based and rigorously evaluated before that person's allowed to speak. It's buyer beware, basically.
Yeah, that's why I kept saying in my last episode that the consumer needs to educate themselves. I'm very lucky to have you and a few more people like you that when I see something new, I just present, say, like, what do I do with this? Shall I use? And with that said, I want to now jump into the testing. Why testing is important, even though it's a vitamin? What can or cannot happen if the right supplement is not chosen? And also, I know you're so careful when you suggest a supplement brand. Why is that?
Particularly here in the United States, other countries like Turkey, for example, have a more rigorous oversight of the supplement industry. I'm going to use B12 as an example. So we all know that we need vitamin B12. It's an important vitamin that helps us produce energy on a cellular basis inside the cell itself. It helps us make neurotransmitters. Very important that you've got enough B12 so that your brain can make serotonin. It helps me make estrogen. It helps for men to make testosterone. It's a really, really important thing that most of us used to be able to get pretty readily from our food. And that's a whole nother conversation for another day. But the idea is most people have heard of B12. Most people know it's important for how their red blood cells work. And so people will take B12. Here's the problem. First of all, you don't know how much to take, and the form of the B12 is really important. So when I have a patient who comes in, I just don't automatically give them B12, although I'm pretty sure at some point we're going to have to. First of all, I would have their blood drawn. I would look at B12, I would look at folate, and I would look at another substance called homocysteine. Homocysteine is this toxic substance that is produced in the body if you don't have enough B12, and it's toxic to your heart and your brain. We look at those levels and we decide, oh yes, you're not in the optimal, not just the normal range, but the optimal range for your age, your gender, your general health. So we determine this person has low B12. They need more. So there are ways to get that. But the problem is, if I haven't looked at the homocysteine, I might just say, okay, go to your pharmacy, go to your drugstore, go to the grocery store and get a B12 supplement. And for probably 50% of the population, that's fine. That's fine. They will take it. Their B12 levels will go up. And then here we go. We are able to see improved function. But for at least 40% of the population of Europe, the United States, and Asia, they are genetically unable to activate the B12. So even if they're eating a really clean diet and they're eating lots of green leafy vegetables and they're doing all of the things that you need to do to increase your B12 naturally, or even if they're taking a supplement, their liver can't activate it. It can't take it from the food or from the vitamin tablet and convert it into the activated form. So I can tell them to eat broccoli and I can tell them to eat some red meat and they will do all that or take their supplement, and it doesn't make one bit of difference. And for me, that homocysteine is the thing that tells me the difference. So if their homocysteine levels are high and their B12 level is low, then I can make an assumption. Or if I'm very concerned, I can do a genetic test to find out these people can't activate their B12 from their diet or from a regular vitamin that they pick up at the store, even a good quality, expensive vitamin. If it is not in the form of what we call methylcobalamin, it's already got this methyl group, carbon and 3 hydrogen attached to that B12 so that it's now active and all the cells in the body can use it, in the brain, in the bones, in the immune system. All of these things can now use the B12 because it's active and it can enter the cells. So if I don't measure that, and I don't know, then I'm just going to tell them to go get something called cobalamin, which is what you'll see if you look at the back of most vitamins. Even if it has B12 in it, if you look at the ingredient listing, it'll say cobalamin. That's the chemical name of B12. But for most people, they need the methylcobalamin. Of course, it's more expensive and it's harder to find. I have some people that even taking it orally in the methylated form, they still can't absorb it because they have problems with their stomach. And there's something that your stomach produces called intrinsic factor that helps you absorb the B vitamin, whatever form it is, and take it out of the food, out of the supplement, and get it into the bloodstream. So we have to measure again. I may find that this person is taking it. They're using the sublingual form so that it's bypassing the stomach. And still their levels aren't right. And so sometimes they have to have a B12 injection. So you can't just measure it once. You can't just make an assumption, oh, everybody needs B12, so go get some at the store. You have to investigate and follow and make sure that you have the right form, you have the right dose, the person is absorbing it, because otherwise they're going to spend time, money, and effort, and they are not going to get any result. And you have to have a good quality form. And again, because especially here in the U.S., there's not really oversight over the safety, cleanliness, making sure that what is in that capsule or in that tablet is actually what they're claiming on the bottle. You need to use good quality supplement companies that use the same standards in my opinion, the gospel according to Susan, but they use the same standards that you would see in manufacturing other kinds of medications that are overseen by the FDA and the DEA. So all of these things come into play in knowing that you need B12. There's a lot more to the equation, and it's an ongoing process to make sure that we are optimizing your supply of B12. And I know that's a long answer, but hopefully that illustrates the complexity of understanding I need B12, and here's a bottle of B12, but is this the right bottle, the right formula, and the right type to help me feel better?
On many conversations with it before, I know that you pick one example, but we're trying to show people that testing is important, whether for vitamin D or B or whatnot. And also through the functional medicine eyes, I know that the optimal level is very important. And can you please tell me why that optimal level that you guys are looking for? I would like to give the information to people because, you know, they're afraid when they see their, let's say, B, let's not talk just about B, but if their B level is very high or their D level is just about 50 or any other level, I know from you that you're looking for the optimal levels, and probably most, I don't want to say every, but most functional medicine doctor is looking for that. What is this for?
When we look at how, again, medicine has evolved, if you go to your doctor and you get some blood work done, and let's say you get a vitamin D level, and the range is 30 to 100. 30 to 100, that's a huge range. So do you need to just be at 30? What happens if you're above 100? Most doctors are happy and satisfied if you're in that range, 30 to 100, somewhere, not really understanding the optimal. So if you're in the 30 range of vitamin D, for example, that means that you probably are not going to get rickets, which is a terrible bone disease that we used to see a lot, where people's bones were just too soft because they didn't have enough vitamin D. So years ago in the United States, we added vitamin D to milk. So we don't see rickets. We don't see bad scoliosis where the spine is all crooked or the bone, the people are really bow-legged because they haven't had enough vitamin D. But that's not sufficient. And one of the things that we learned through COVID, especially, is that people who had a vitamin D level between 60 and 80, these are the people that were going to do much better if they got a COVID infection. These are people that their immune system was going to be strong enough. And even though they're sick and maybe even really sick, they're going to do well. So a level of 30 might be just fine for your doctor saying that you're in the 30 to 100. But the reality is if you've got COVID, you're going to be as sick as somebody who has a vitamin D level of 10. We know my other area of specialty is psychiatry. And so for someone who is depressed, particularly someone who gets depressed in the wintertime, that doesn't mean go get Prozac or fluoxetine. That means you got to have more vitamin D. And that is how we treat seasonal mood disorder, is we get the vitamin D level up closer to 80. Mm-hmm. Now, with vitamin D, you don't want it to be too high, because vitamin D is stored in your fat cells, and you can get too much. And there have been cases where people have actually died of vitamin D poisoning. Now, it's rare, and you would have to take a whole bunch of vitamin D, but it's possible. So again, you got to make sure with the vitamin D that you're not too high. And so regulating that, knowing the optimal range, what's going to help you with infections, what's going to help you with bone growth, what's going to help your immune system, what's going to help your mood, what's going to help your energy. There is a window that's much more narrow than the whole broad window of we want to fight rickets. We don't want people to have soft bones. So that was the, let's get you to 30. You're not going to get rickets. So there are many reasons why you might want a particular hormone or a particular vitamin or a particular amino acid to be in a certain range. Too much may be bad, too little may be worthless. It's not going to help you with what you're mm-hmm. looking for. With the B vitamins, like B12, they are water soluble. So all you have for today is all you're ever as all you get. You can't store it. Your body can't make it. And therefore, if you eat your green leafy vegetables today, you might be fine. But tomorrow, if you don't, you're not going to have enough B. So sometimes we want a higher range of the B vitamins. And if the range goes above the 1100 or 1200, with me, that's okay, unless the person has problems with their kidneys. If they're above that, that's okay, because any extra is going to just be excreted from your body in your urine. So that's not going to be harmful, like too much of the fat soluble, the vitamin A, the D, the E, these kinds of vitamins. We have to be much more careful. Again, a reason to keep making sure we've got the blood work in the optimal range.
Just because it's a vitamin and it's over the counter, one, we need to pay attention to not to buy any brand. We need to make sure that they're manufactured under pharmaceutical grade
standards. A number of years ago, tryptophan was an over-the-counter supplement that is very useful. Your brain takes that, it can cross into the brain, it takes that and makes serotonin out of it. Tryptophan is very helpful for sleep. That's one of the old wives' tales of drinking warm milk before you go to bed is actually true, because warming the milk releases the tryptophan in the milk and it helps you go to sleep. But there was some contamination out of a manufacturing company. I believe it was in Japan, but don't quote me on that. And I don't mean to insult or offend anybody, but there was a company that, because their standards were not where they needed to be, there was contamination in the tryptophan. So people were taking the tryptophan supplements. Everybody was happy, sleeping well, mood was better. But this contaminant killed some people because they weren't using good quality standards. They weren't using good quality ingredients, and they weren't monitoring for contamination like we do with regular mm-hmm. medicine. So they pulled tryptophan off the market. At least here in the United States, you couldn't get it. And it's given people some pause because they all remember, I don't know what happened, but we shouldn't take tryptophan, which if you use a good quality, it's fine. But this is some of the things that can happen when it's the wild, wild west of supplements. So over the counter, just as you said a minute ago, does not mean it's safe.
This is a fun interview because I have all these notes over here. Like I have so many questions, which I already asked to you probably, but I remembered new ones. So there's this two thoughts, two beliefs. One, like you focus to the whole person and the brain. And I kind of consider your practice that you do biohacking and neurohacking over there, like literally. There's another school of thought that is so focused to microbiomes. And they think that they can resolve every issue through the gut. And we had multiple conversations, especially I do so many tests and like with the first result coming out, I said, Susan, this is low, this is high. And you, I don't care. It's not going to go through your blood-brain barrier. What's your thought about these two separate school of thought and how much it's connected? At least your view. I don't want to be quoting you that what Susan says is right. It's kind of right for me, but you know, I don't want to influence other people.
And that's a very, very good point. For many years, we just ignored what was going on in our GI system, which goes from your mouth all the way through your body to your anus. It's an actual tube that's open to the outside because food goes in, what we drink goes in, sometimes what we breathe goes in, and then it goes out the other end. And the genius of our gastrointestinal system is that our body knows what to take out, what to dump into the GI system, dump into the colon and the small intestine so that it can be eliminated and taken out of our body. So it takes in our nourishment, it takes out our trash. It's a really important system that we have ignored for a long time. What we do know, for example, is that most of the serotonin in our body is actually made in our intestines. Much more than is made in our brain. And so sometimes antidepressants, when you take them, if they work on serotonin, they're going to create things like nausea, sometimes vomiting, sometimes diarrhea, because they're making more serotonin and it's impacting the GI system. But the brain is a closed system. We have a very good filtering system around our brain and our spinal cord that keeps large molecules out, that keeps toxins out, that keeps big bugs and bacteria and things out of our brain for our protection. And so that's the good news. The bad news is that the brain has to gather out of the bloodstream some of the molecules that can cross the blood-brain barrier to make serotonin. And what you measure in your gut in terms of serotonin is not what's in your brain. So in my opinion, for example, you can't say that you're serotonin deficient by just looking at what's coming out of your gut or coming out in your urine, because that's not measuring what's in the brain. To measure the brain, you have to do a spinal tap to actually look, because it's a closed different system. All being said, we do know that our intestines are our biggest protection against inflammation and against autoimmune diseases. And if there's a breakdown in our intestinal, that very strict boundary from letting, you know, not letting into our blood system bad stuff, but absorbing, allowing the absorption of the good stuff we need, the very important, delicate system. And if there's damage to that lining of the intestine because we've been taking antibiotics because we need them, we've got a sinus infection, but we've now disturbed our gut system and we've disturbed that barrier and we may be getting toxins coming through that intestinal wall that are harmful to us. So we have to pay attention to it. We need to be much more clear about making sure that we've got the right things in our intestines and that we are eliminating the bad things. One of the ways to know if you've got some bad gut bacteria is how much do you crave sugar? Because normal gut bacteria doesn't really use sugar as its food or energy source. Bad gut bacteria love sugar. So that's why when you see a lot of the weight loss claims associated with probiotics or prebiotics or postbiotics, they're talking about you can lose weight if you do this. And sometimes you can because it's helping to eliminate that bad gut bacteria that's chewing up all the sugar and making you crave sugar, not because you want it, because they want it. It's helping to repopulate your gut so that you have the good, protective, strong gut bacteria that's keeping bad things out of your system and allowing all the junk and the trash to come into the bowel, into the stool, and be eliminated from your body.
So this last section, I want to talk about, it doesn't need to be too long because I want to make a separate session about the brain, but knowing my brain imaging, when I fell from the window when I was 4.5, you were able to see many, many years later the TBI, traumatic brain injury on one of my temporal lobes.
Yes.
We worked on that. With that example, I would like to be able to talk a little bit about how it is important to actually do some brain imagings on people when we see some odd behaviors or abnormal behaviors or out of the ordinary behaviors. Maybe sometimes too much depression, maybe sometimes they don't have a good balance, because the understanding is unless you have a concussion, there's nothing wrong with you. So they let you go with your life. And I listened to many lectures of Dr. Daniel Amen as well. And it was fascinating how actually people need to pay attention to not to dive head in first into the water, from to playing soccer, to hit the ball with your head, like these even small things. So, you know, I think that would be very important because it's a part of functional medicine.
Correct.
It's a very important part for me, the functional medicine, and it's a part of testing as well.
If you were to look at a living, live brain, which I have had the privilege of seeing in neurosurgery and other parts of my study of medicine, the living brain is like looking at a 3-pound bowl of oatmeal, the breakfast cereal. It has shape. And it has form, but it is extremely fragile and it's malleable. It's covered in 3 layers of saran wrap that we call the meninges that holds the brain in place. Then it's floating in cerebral spinal fluid, which acts as a shock absorber. So there's fluid all around the brain and down into the spinal cord that allows us, if we jostle or we, you know, stop suddenly in the car, our brain doesn't just keep pounding back and forth across our other protective layer, which is our skull. So we have this strong skull that then has skin and hair for some of us, that protects our brain. But our brain is incredibly fragile and it's very specialized. Each of the neurons in the brain have different functions and they control every single thing about what we do, what we think, how well our health, when we breathe, all of that kind of stuff is controlled by this very important small unit in our brain. If you hit your head and you go to the doctor and they say, well, let's do a CT scan and see if you have a concussion. They're looking, is there bleeding? They're looking, is your skull fractured? Is there actually the bone broken? They're looking for structural changes. And sometimes we can see that and they go, oh, yes, you have a concussion. Here's what we're going to do. But what those kinds of images, the MRI, the CT scans, they can't tell us how the brain is actually functioning. Has it been damaged on a cellular level that might not be able to be seen in the structure? So when we use EEG, we're looking at the electrical activity of the brain. We have 2 electrical organs in our body. We have our heart and we have our brain. If the doctor wants to see, is your heart working correctly? They'll put the leads on. They'll put the little pasties on your chest and on your leg, and they will look at the electrical activity of your heart and they can say, oh, you've had a heart attack, or you're having some problems with how your heart's beating, and they will do some interventions. When we put the EEG, looks like a strange swimming cap, we are looking at the actual electrical activity of the brain. And this has been studied since the 60s, first studied in NASA, for looking at how the brain is actually functioning in real time. And in your case, we were able to see where, even though many years later, and you're obviously a highly functioning, intelligent adult who's accomplished much in her life, but even still, there was some injury. Your brain was not working as well as it needed to be. And this clearly shows up in either too little electrical activity in a spot or too much electrical activity, more than we would have expected. And so this is really important because it allows me and other clinicians to be able to diagnose anxiety, attention deficit, problems with memory, problems with balance, problems with focus, depression, bipolar disorder, obsessive compulsive disorder. These have signatures, if you will, just like we can see in an EKG. Oh, you've had a heart attack. We can see, oh, you've had a brain injury.
That part is very important for me. Therefore, I just wanted to conclude our chat with this information because I know that I'm going to invite you to the podcast many, many more times. And with this one, I wanted to have a little sneak peeks of many small things that we cannot explain in one episode. Probably very soon, I'm going to invite you and we're going to pick a topic. Our viewers are sending us messages through Instagram saying, oh, we want to know more about the subject. Yes. When that time comes, we're going to then pick a topic and then we will go very deep in that topic.
And I look forward to that. And I hope that this is helpful because this is in many ways cutting edge information, but it really does provide your listeners with the ability to think and begin to have a skeptical and yet focused view on what's the best thing for my health and how do I best live my best life. So thank you for the invite. It's a pleasure to be here and pleasure to see you.
Thank you, Susan.